Ah, good morning.
Good morning.
Here we are. Woo. Woo. We've been in our Rohatsu retreat, in which we celebrate Buddha's enlightenment. We do this every year. And some of us have been here for 7 days, and some for five, and some for a couple. And it's been quite a ride.
It is okay.
Yeah.
I'm not getting someone back here.
Yeah? Okay. Should I keep talking? I'll just... Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So it's great. I feel really quite focused and a little ragged at the same time, if that's possible. It's sort of a ragged focus. I think I can sustain that for the rest of the day. So it seems like forever, 7 days. You know, this is really life lived deliberately, I think. You know you're alive. Say what you will about long retreats. You know you're alive. You pay attention. This is being present for life, you know. And a lot of things arise. A little of everything, probably all the emotions. But one thing that arises a lot is gratitude. A lot of gratitude. When you get time to slow down and you're with these other people in this zendo, all these hours during a day, just making these quiet, simple movements, you feel a lot of love and a lot of gratitude. I've been inspired by the practice of everyone here. And so for those of you who have come in today for the talk, welcome. I'm so glad you're here. This is a little different from an ordinary Sunday. There won't be any tea afterwards. There won't be any talking. It's silent. And people may not even make eye contact with you. But that doesn't mean they're being unfriendly. It helps us to maintain... our focus. So we've been lecturing all week, Ben and me, Ben Connolly. He did the first lectures the first 3 days, and then he had to leave to do another retreat. I'm grateful to him for stepping in here. We've been talking about the Genjo Koan, and today is the very last part of the Genjo Koan. The Genjo Koan was written by Dogen, who was born in 1200, right? Not 1300, 1200? 1200 to 1253? Long time ago in Japan. And this is one of his really essential works. And we have come to this part. Therefore, if there are fish that would swim or birds that would fly, only after investigating the entire ocean or sky, they would find neither path nor place. If there are fish that would swim or birds that would fly, only after investigating the entire ocean or sky, they would find neither path nor place. And so I talked a little bit yesterday about the sky and the ocean imagery. The sky and ocean are endless to the bird or the fish. And so you can't really take the measure of anything. You can't really divide infinity into components. And for Dogen, flying and swimming are freedom. Flying and swimming are moving through the world without adding extra things, such as expectations and judgments. And it's just doing what you're doing. It's doing our practice. It's eating our soup with nothing extra. Simply eating our soup. And what a beautiful thing that is when we can quiet down enough to just eat without extra stuff, without comment. The soup is the whole universe at that moment. So, this says that you don't have to understand everything before you begin to do something. So we can take this in different ways. It could be a kind of about a kind of paralysis that can happen. We don't want to do something until we investigate every possible angle, every detail. And so we end up not doing anything at all because we don't get to that point. And this is probably an effort to just to control what is really uncontrollable. A couple of days ago, I told a story about visiting some whales, went whale watching with my wife in a little boat, and how exciting that was, and how scary that was. And I never would have done that if I had sought endless assurances, because at some point you just have to kind of do the scary thing. Now, I am not, of course, advocating rash action in any way here, but sometimes you just have to do it. And I remember when I was thinking about doing my first retreat long ago, and I was thinking about going to Hokyoji for a 3-day Labor Day retreat, and I didn't really know what that was about. I had never done a Zen retreat before. And I was talking to someone here about that, and I think he said, well, if you don't do it now, when are you going to do it? You know, at some point you have to do it now. You can't really wait until you're ready. You're never going to be ready. You're never going to really know what's happening. So I went and I did it, and it was great. And I remember thinking that was about the most difficult and best thing I ever did when it was over. And Shinryu Suzuki's take on this passage is that you don't have to understand intellectually before practicing. And this has kind of come up for me when I've taught ritual. Tim has talked about how Suzuki had them chant the Heart Sutra, I think every day, maybe twice a day, for something like 2 years before he ever said a word about what it was about. And you know, it's kind of impenetrable at first. So people were doing this chant without knowing what it was about. And that was fine with Suzuki. He just wanted them to do it to get it into their bones. And so when I teach ritual, I tend to say, well, just do it. You know, just do it. But I got a lot of requests. You know, we'd really like to know what this is about before we do it. And I get that, especially if you're going to be bowing down, which looks like really kind of a worshipful thing. You would like to know kind of what that's about before you do it. And that makes perfect sense to me. And I added that in, and I was happy to do that. But it's nice to have an open mind and be able to jump into, not take the full measure of something before you do it, because that's kind of like an effort to predict what's going to happen. I'm not comfortable unless I know what's going to happen. But of course, in life, we jump into the next moment not knowing what it is. And if we're meditating, if we're doing our practice, that's exactly what we need to do. Jump into the next moment not knowing what it is. If you have any idea of what it is, you're not jumping into it. It's got to be a surprise. So, simply step forth. Just stand up in this moment. You don't have to think about what will happen after this moment. And that's good advice for a retreat like this, because the han and the bells will tell you what to do. You don't have to even think about it. You don't have to think about the next thing at all. So continuing here with Dogen, when we make this very place our own, our practice becomes the actualization of reality, Genjo Koan. When we make this path our own, our activity naturally becomes actualized reality, Genjo Koan. This path, this place, is neither big nor small, neither self nor others. It has not existed before this moment, nor has it come into existence now. Therefore, the reality of all things is thus. So this is the first time after the title that he's used that word, Genjo Koan, and we must be getting to the heart of things here. There's a lot in this passage. I would just like to note that I think there's kind of a change in tone here at the end of the Genjo Koan. If you're familiar with Dogen, you know that he continually pulls the rug out from under us. He loves to do that. He loves to set up some principles and then immediately tear them down. And he never gives you a place to stand. He is, as Ben said, the master deconstructionist. That's what he does. That is how he is helping us to free our minds. And he's austere. He's austere. His practice, his form of practice, which still continues today at Eiheiji in Japan, which is a temple he founded, is very austere, very tough. But toward the end of the Genjo Koan, and maybe just slightly in this passage, but more later, he starts getting a little bit happier. And he even kind of hints at the benefits of practice, not something you normally hear from him. And I think that's good. And I'm going to unabashedly talk later a little bit about the benefits of practice. We don't always do that because we don't want to encourage goal-orientedness. We don't want small mind to grasp at these things. But think of it this way. Delusion and enlightenment are not two. Small mind, big mind is a false dichotomy. Practice is the way we eliminate that dichotomy. So then, joy in the path through practice with no distinctions is something we should acknowledge. But still, this isn't exactly about the fruits of practice. This isn't exactly about rewards. It's about the continually unfolding present and the joy of that. There's no place for reward in the continuing unfolding present. Unless you think of it as constant reward, I guess you can. But reward implies the past. You did something in the past, now you get your reward. There is no past, there's just this. So it's not a grasping sort of joy I'm talking about. It's not the small self, the wanting self saying, oh, I've gotten something nice for myself now. It's that deeper abiding joy, flying through the air, swimming in the sea. And it's the pure delight that seeks and needs nothing. It's like the pure delight that we take in the Sangha. You know, I really enjoy this privilege of being with people who are incredibly kind, and they let that kindness permeate their lives, and they're courageous, and they go out and act in the world, and they stand up in the world. And that is one of the greatest joys that we have, is to be able to share that in our Sangha. So, continuing, in the same way, when a person engages in practice enlightenment in the Buddha way, as the person realizes one Dharma, the person permeates that Dharma. As the person encounters one practice, the person fully practices that practice. For this, there is a place and path. So, fully practice that practice. Shohaku Okamura puts it this way, although having no beginning or end and permeating all time and space, this path exists only at this very moment, right now, and right here. So, we do one thing at a time. One thing at a time. And that's what we hope to do in retreat. And we get distracted. We realize we're distracted. We come back. But a good example, I think, of doing one thing at a time is the tasks of the Tenzo. The Tenzo is the cook during the retreat. And that's cooking for a lot of people. And it could get frantic, like in a restaurant. But it's not like that. I'm sure there are times when things have to move pretty fast. But basically, when I go into the kitchen, I see our Tenzos moving deliberately and doing one thing at a time. Even though they have all of these complex considerations, they're doing one thing, they're doing another thing, and between things, they're just there, not nervously looking around. And it's had good results, really good food. We've had traditional Japanese food, Sishin food, this week, and it's been pretty exciting. There was this one thing, it's a pickled plum, which may not sound good, but that may be the most exciting thing I've ever seen in an Oryoki bowl. That had a kick to it. So, Shohaku again, when we give all of our attention and energy to the task or practice before us, we can truly penetrate it. We do this over and over again with whatever we encounter, one thing at a time, each time. The boundary of the known is not clear. This is because the known, which appears limited, is born and practices simultaneously with the complete penetration of the Buddha Dharma. We should not think that what we have attained is conceived by ourselves and known by our discriminating mind. Although complete enlightenment is immediately actualized, its intimacy is such that it does not necessarily form as a view. In fact, viewing is not something fixed. And again, there's a lot there, but he's basically saying, wait a minute. Don't think, just because I've started to be a little bit nice to you, that you've obtained something. He's pulling out the rug again. He talked about there's a place and a path. Oh, that sounds nice. I have a place. I have a path. And maybe he imagined someone like me taking those words to heart and talking about joy and love for the Sangha and coming really close to just kind of indulging in these things, despite all my disclaimers. So it's like, okay, wait a minute. Don't turn this into a thought. Don't turn this into a view. It's okay to say, I have a path, but the minute you start thinking of yourself as being on the path, you're not experiencing the single step of this moment. Because there is never arrival. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, when you do your walking meditation with your steps, you can say, I have arrived. I am home. I have arrived. I am home. Even becoming a Buddha is not the end of the story. Becoming a Buddha is the starting point of life as a Buddha. I mentioned the other day that I did my initiation, my Jukai, with Shohaku Okumura. I think it was here. I think it was 22 years ago. And that was great. I had no idea what a great teacher I had. I was new to all of this. And we had a 15-minute meeting, and the reason for that was so that he could give me a name. And I remember that meeting pretty distinctly because I referred to Jukai as a goal, as a wonderful goal for me to have or something like that. And he said that lay ordination is not a goal. It is a beginning. And he gave me the name Donin, which means way of mindfulness. And I think maybe he was reminding me that I need to be mindful moment after moment, not keep goals in front of me. And I appreciate that because I still need to be reminded of that. So then the last chapter here, we're covering two chapters today. The last chapter is number 11. The first part of that is on your program. So the Genjo Koan ends with a story. It's a koan, basically. And here's how it goes. The student says to the master, the nature of wind is ever present and permeates everywhere. Why are you waving a fan? The master said, you know only that wind's nature is ever present. You don't know that it permeates everywhere. The monk said, how does wind permeate everywhere? The master just continued waving the fan. The monk bowed deeply. So, I've read a number of commentaries on this, and they agree that wind here is Buddha nature. And Shohaku writes about Buddha nature and how it was first thought of as sort of this hidden, dormant potential we have to become a Buddha. But this was thought of as being too similar to the idea of having a soul, something permanent and abiding. It's this kind of view that we're deluded on the outside, but inside we have this sort of permanent knowing thing, this undiluted self. But in Mahayana Buddhism, we don't say that Buddha nature is something hidden and separate. Instead, there are two aspects of living beings that exist simultaneously, and they are the same. And Shohaku expresses it by saying that in ultimate reality, all beings are enlightened Buddhas from the beginning. But in phenomenal reality, we are deluded, and therefore we need to practice and study to restore our original enlightenment and become Buddhas. We're all Buddhas, we just don't know it yet, or we don't realize it yet. And in ultimate reality, we are perfect as we are. In phenomenal reality, we need some work. And so the wind is everywhere. Buddha nature is none other than reality itself. Therefore, it is everywhere. The question, why do you wave a fan when wind nature is everywhere? And this reflects Dogen's burning question. When he was really still quite a young man, he had this burning question that consumed him. And he left his monastery and he went to China because of this question. If all beings are the Dharma nature from the beginning, why do all Buddhas have to arouse Bodhi mind, engage in difficult practices, attain awakening, and enter nirvana? So, if we are all Buddha, why do we have to practice? It's a pretty good question. If the wind is everywhere, why do we have to fan ourselves? And this makes me think of the introduction I do sometimes and how I talk about accepting things, letting things be what they are. And I always add a disclaimer to that, that that's about seeing. That when I say accept things, I'm not talking about accepting injustice or anything like that. I'm talking about seeing clearly. Accept the reality of the situation. Once you see clearly, it's time to do something about it. It is time to act as a bodhisattva. And this relates a little bit to a question I received yesterday after my talk. And to paraphrase it, was basically, if we're all perfect beings, what about people who do bad things? How are they perfect beings? And it was a good question, and I'd like to try to give a little more of a complete answer. As Shohaku says, in ultimate reality, we are perfect as we are, but in phenomenal reality, we are deluded, and we do unskillful things, and some people do very bad things. Well, they have not realized their Buddha nature. So when I'm talking about our perfect nature, I'm talking about our Buddha nature, which is here now, but we don't always see it, and we don't always act in accordance with it. And I like to emphasize our perfect nature because I want us to realize our potential. I want us to believe in our incredible potential to transform ourselves and to transform the world. But I also need to emphasize that when people act badly, that is not acceptable. And seeing all beings as perfect never means accepting or excusing bad behavior. And in fact, we must act in the world to oppose bad behavior. That's part of our bodhisattva vow. Our bodhisattva vow. All things are connected. And when I see that your heart and my heart is the same, I want to protect your heart. And I also want to protect my heart. So, wind is everywhere. Why are you waving a fan? The master said, you only know that wind's nature is ever present. You don't know that it permeates everywhere. Suzuki says that the student understands that form is emptiness, but doesn't understand that emptiness is form. The student has maybe had some experience and has seen that all things are empty, but the student doesn't realize that once having seen emptiness, we have to practice in the world as bodhisattvas. that even after we become Buddhas, we have to continue practicing in order to express our Buddha nature. That's what practice is about. It's not about getting somewhere. It's about expressing our Buddha nature. And then here's the kicker. The teacher did not answer. He merely kept waving the fan, which I think is a pretty good response, don't you? Enough talking. Let's talk about that. So the story ends not with an answer, intellectual answer, but with a simple action. And the student bows deeply. He finally gets it. So awakening is not enough. We must manifest awakening day after day. But that story is not quite the end of the Genjo Koan. There's a little more. The genuine experience of Buddha Dharma and the vital path that has been correctly transmitted are like this. To say that we should not wave a fan because the nature of wind is ever present, and that we should feel the wind even when we don't wave a fan, is to know neither ever-presence nor the wind's nature. Okay, continuing with the theme. And then we have this. Since the wind's nature is ever-present, the wind of the Buddha's family enables us to realize the gold of the great earth and to transform the water of the long river into cream. What? What just happened? So throughout this thing, he's used this really simple imagery. He's got a boat, he's got a bird, he's got a fish. He talks about firewood and ash. Really simple things that aren't really appealing to our grasping self so much. You know, we don't get too excited about firewood, like, oh, I want some firewood. But now he gives us these three images that seem to kind of come from the world of desire and fulfillment, you know, of desire. Family, gold, and cream. Nice things. And I think he's saying, hey, here at the end, I'm going to lighten up a little bit. I'm going to use this language of human desire, love, the world of forms. And so Dogen, who never throws us a bone, throws us a bone. And I think that's fine. I think we can take it. We're not going to get all graspy. If we acknowledge that we love this practice in myriad complex ways. When I take refuge in the Buddha, sometimes it's the refuge of no refuge, but sometimes it's really refuge, and that's okay. So the Buddha's family, well, that's just a nice image, the Buddha's family. I guess that's all of us. That's our family, my family, this family. And then gold, well, that has, I think, it's just its traditional meaning. It's something valuable. And then we have transforming the water of the long river into cream. What is this? I was talking to a friend of mine who used to practice here with Katagiri long, long ago. And whenever I meet someone who knew Katagiri, I just ask them questions about what Katagiri was like, because I so want to know and I so want to connect. And he said, well, he was always talking about this river of cheese or this river of cottage cheese or something. And I never got that. I didn't know what that was about. And some translations say cream, some say cheese. I like to think of it as cream cheese. And Suzuki says it's a quotation from the Gandaviyuha Sutra, which I don't think I've read. The water of the long river is supposed to be pure milk, but if the pure milk does not go through the right process, it cannot become cheese. Milk is milk and cheese is cheese. So if you want to ripen cheese, you should work on it. So kind of fits the theme, right? Even though there's enough wind, if you don't use the fan to call it forth, it will not make you cool. Even though there's gold on the earth, if you don't pick it up, you can't get the gold. You're perfect already, but you must practice to realize you're perfect already. Uchiyama says, you can't stop breathing because you breathed in the past. You may think, well, I don't need to breathe anymore because I breathed a whole lot in my life. Not true. Same with a Buddha. Well, oh, I can stop practicing now. I don't think so. So as I said, I'm feeling a lot of gratitude in this retreat. And to finish up, I would just like to speak from my heart a little bit and talk about why we practice, why I practice, a little bit about why I became a Zen priest. And I kind of wrote the outline for this driving in one morning of retreat. Things kind of come to me when I'm driving in. And I was just feeling overwhelmed with gratitude. And why I became a Zen priest, I think, has to do with the transformative power of this practice. I told you, I'm going to talk unabashedly about that. And I think of how things were early in my life, you know. And it was pretty good. I've always been a pretty lucky person. But when I was younger, I was really burdened with a lot of anxiety. My relationship with anxiety has changed so very much. It's really not much of a burden anymore. And I think about how I used to get angry and how I almost never get angry anymore, which continually surprises me because it's a pretty deep change. And I think about how I used to focus on a lot of negative things. I focus on a lot of positive things now. I think about how at one time I could not engage in public speaking to save my life. And I think the transformational power of this practice is just astonishing, or at least it has been. It has been for me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. And ironically, I had to lose myself in order to find myself. I really did. I really lost it, but it came back, and it's getting along pretty well with Big Mind. But so when you experience a transformation like that, something positive, you can't help but want to share that with others. And of course, it's not just me. That's the common trajectory. And Zen practice, I know, is not the only way to live a better life. It's not the only way I know of to engage in your life in a deliberate way and then take that deliberate way and use that to guide others. There are ways in many spiritual traditions to do this. There are lots of ways to do this outside of spiritual traditions, although most people need a guide at some point. And I don't care how you do it. This isn't about building the institution of Zen. It isn't about getting a lot of people to join Zen. It's about finding the kind, deliberate, effective, joyful, and loving path. And any way you can find that, that is wonderful. But Zen is the way that I know deeply. And it's the path that has changed the world for me. It has changed the world down to the world's bones for me. And I've seen it do that for many others as well. And I see from the literature that's been going on for 2,500 years since the enlightenment of Shakyamuni Buddha, which we celebrate today, by the way. We have Buddha up here. We usually have Manjushri, but today we have the Buddha. And I can't promise that Zen will help you. It's not right for everybody, but I think most people who practice seriously say, that was pretty good. That was helpful. That was helpful. And so my job as a Zen teacher, as a Zen priest, is to share this with others. You know, I invite others, and if they want to do that, that's fine. Or if they come to me, that's fine. I don't go out and say, hey, you should do this. But I want to share this fundamental fact that comes from Dogen in the 13th century, which is that in order to enjoy the sweet cream cheese of the Long River, you have to do the practice. You have to do the practice. And that means a few things. And one is turning away from those things that are not good for you. And you probably know what they are. And I'm sorry, if you want to be serious about this practice, you're going to have to spend less time on your phone. And total abstinence is not required. We're pretty forgiving. But if you cut back on harmful things enough that you start to feel better, you know, those first few days or first few weeks might just be pure discipline. It's hard to do and I hate it. But after a while, you get a little momentum and it starts to feel kind of good. Like, gee, I feel a lot better not doing that thing. I would much rather not do that thing. So you get a little momentum. And another is turning toward those things that are good for you. Doing this practice. Spending the time meditating. It doesn't have to be a lot of time. As I've often said, when I first started meditating really seriously, I practiced religiously 5 minutes a day. And it made a difference in my life. I was doing other things at the time. Something had changed in my heart. Something changed in my heart and 5 minutes a day. And it was the magic combination. I gradually increased that amount of sitting. And I engaged in mindful activity. That's a good thing to do. Hearing Dharma talks. And eventually, when the time is right, finding a teacher. And all of this, of course, comes from love. It comes from love. That is the source of all of this. That's what this path is about. And I would encourage you to do this. And it's more than encouragement. It's deep in my being. It's in the fiber of my bones. Please do this. Please find your way to do this. To live deliberately in this world in a place coming from love. And actually, I feel kind of silly saying that right here because I feel so much love and I know so many of you and I know you're coming from that place now. So, yeah. It's hard. This path is hard because you have to give up some things. You have to give up some things that give you immediate pleasure. If you want some encouragement, think of people in retreat here, if you've come in from outside today. You know, I can't speak for everyone in the retreat about what they're feeling. I suspect for most people there have been some great highs and some great lows and probably some boredom and some confusion and some exuberance and some gentle stillness. But I think it's likely that for most people, at some point, there has been this great open-heartedness where they just feel kind of an unequivocal love for all people, for all beings. And all of our chants, it seems, are about how we are doing this practice for all beings. We're sitting here in support of you, in support of your family, in support of the whole world. And I really do believe deeply that our sitting helps others. Does it help others in some direct way while we're doing it? I don't know. I keep an open mind about that. Does it help others in the sense that it makes us better people and we go out in the world and we do better things? Absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes, sitting on my zafu in retreat, I open myself to this love for all beings. And something happens. I get emotional. I kind of laugh and cry at the same time. And I kind of shake, but do not be alarmed. I don't know if anyone is aware of this, because I think not, because I'm facing in and everybody else is facing the wall. But if you ever see out of the corner of your eye that I'm kind of doing this vibrating thing, do not be alarmed. It's a good sign. It's a good sign. It's just gratitude. It's just gratitude. It's feeling the deepness of the love. Feeling the deepness of the love. And so most people, when you show up here, they're not going to immediately start vibrating. They're not going to immediately start talking about the sweet cream cheese of the Long River, because either of those things would freak you out. But people show their love in quiet ways. they sit and they look at the wall for 7 days. And they carefully prepare cheese and crackers and hummus and tea. And they rake the leaves and they shovel the snow. They lead the intro. They clean the bathrooms. And they bow deeply to their Zafu. And they bow deeply in their hearts to you when you're not looking. And I'm in a privileged position because today I'm the Doshi. And the greatest privilege of all of this is that I get to say these things out loud about what this is all about and to say, please join us. Please join us in doing this work of saving all beings and in taking this joyful path. Often in Rohatsu, we don't take questions, and that just kind of feels right today not to do that. I hope you'll understand if I don't take questions.